Good morning and welcome to another edition of Tree Huggers International on 107.7 The End. My name is Tommy Howe, and Tree Huggers International is a weekly natural science and environmental affairs program for the listeners of 107.7 The End and all of Western Washington, from the Columbia River to the San Juan Islands and everywhere in between. Be careful and use this show with caution, because you might just learn something. Recently on Tree Huggers International, we had a panel of architectural professionals active in green building and sustainable architecture practices. And this week, we have another guest on the program from the green building movement, for lack of a better term, Nora Daly Pang, who is a project associate at O'Brien & Company here in Seattle. Nora is also active with the preservation of green belts in her neighborhood in Beacon Hill for ecological and safety purposes, and also to enhance community connectivity. Is everyone ready to talk about ecological footprints? Good. Welcome to Tree Huggers International. Nora, thank you for joining us this morning.
Good morning. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. And it's wonderful to be talking about this, because I had this panel of architects on a few weeks ago, so I almost feel like I'm this far away from being an expert on the matter now. But let's talk about the work you guys do at O'Brien & Company. Now, you are a project associate there. What does that mean?
What O'Brien & Company does is we have four branches of service, and all of them are to promote sustainable development in the Northwest region. And the four branches are residential, consulting, commercial, and institutional, which is where my effort falls. And then we have a educational arm to help move everyone along. And the fourth arm is research and policy.
Research and policy. So is this learning about other building practices and how to perhaps pitch those to certain communities?
Well, oftentimes cities contract with us because they want to assess what their practices are right now, as far as, we'll take, for example, purchasing. A city might purchase a lot of different materials, even within an office setting, and they want to understand what type of environmental impact that has. And so we will take that list and really do a deep research on where those materials are coming from, what type of environmental impact, what type of energy is embodied in them. And at the end of the day, we'll come up with recommendations on how they can improve their practices.
Have you always done this type of work, this kind of angle on building?
Actually, I'm a landscape architect. The shift over to green building has been recent for me in the last 4 years. I actually started off taking a course called a Sustainable Building Advisors course at Seattle Community College, which is a program that O'Brien and Company helped craft. And it's designed for working professionals and helps them take their knowledge and understand in a deeper way how to integrate sustainable practices.
And a landscape architect, like, you're sort of walking in the footsteps of like the Olmsted brothers. I mean, you design parks and public places, that sort of
right.
thing. And how do you apply those skills towards sustainable architecture, or green building, as I like to call it, for lack of a better term?
The profession of landscape architecture, there's a lot that we can do as far as stewardship of the land and water and air. I think it's a wonderful profession because we get to collaborate with all the other disciplines and look at those resources and think about how we might have a smaller footprint on the earth.
And let's talk about the whole notion of ecological footprint, because that's another term that we've really been hearing a lot of, really since the Al Gore movie was out last year. But that idea has been around for a longer time, and European cities seem to have figured this out a long time ago. We have X amount of space. We want to keep some green areas between towns. But is this sort of a new idea to the United States? I mean, here it's like property. I own property. I have many acres, you know? And is this an idea that's always been around in the U.S. and it comes in waves, and we're in the middle of a wave right now where it's sort of a popular approach?
I think there is trends that have dictated how development will occur. We can look at before automobiles were widely used. Cities grew organically around the railroad stops, and then eventually there were the subway systems, and it just kind of created that type of density. And can look like specifically here in Seattle or the Cascadia region, development has really been fostered along by our Cascadia range and the Puget Sound, and we've been kind of hemmed in between those two pieces. Now that our population is growing, we're starting to move into the foothills of the Cascades, and we really need to take a step back and look at how we are developing land, because that land and the trees and the farmlands providing important resources for us locally and globally.
Is there some place in the world or some city in the world you can think of, maybe here in the U.S. or not, that sort of reached this critical mass point where it's kind of like, wow, you guys, there's a point of no return here. You guys just, you did it wrong. You're so big and you're so out there. You're sort of a hazard just by virtue of being there. And I don't mean to go and pick on any countries or any cities or anything, but, you know, is there a particular city that could have done a better job of building up and instead just built out?
I don't like picking on any cities, but I just came back from a trip from China, and we stopped at a lot of cities where, you know, the average population is 3 million people, and there's impacts, and there's also coal burning happening. And so just the difference between our lifestyle here in the Northwest and actually experiencing a big city like Nanjing, you start to appreciate what we have here and what we can do to not only preserve what we have, but also teach the world about the things that are working well here so that we can move development along, much like Al Gore is promoting, is not just this fear of that the world's in crisis and we're all going to die, but that here's some tools that we can all collectively build from.
Yeah, you're right. And I think a lot of naysayers always sort of go, well, I don't want to have to feel bad about building something, and it shouldn't all be doom and gloom. And I'm not too sure who's pushing the whole doom and gloom thing here. You know, it's just a realization of the reality of what's going on here. We have X amount of land surface on this earth, and a lot of it just is inhospitable because no one's going to move to the middle of the Sahara. Although funny, we have lots of desert cities here in the American Southwest that may not be the most practical places to go and have a city, but that having been said, China just shot past us in CO2 emissions, but of course, they're all manufacturing stuff that we buy.
Exactly.
But they're also in a point of their economic development where suddenly people are getting a lot of cash, and they can afford to go and buy someplace out in the hills or wherever they may be. And the regulations that we enjoy here in this nation and, you know, in Canada and I think in Europe and parts of the West aren't necessarily in effect there, and not just the impact of factories, but the impact of just cities that are just kind of growing haphazardly and kind of Wild West style. It's like, and let's just pause for a moment and maybe kind of reevaluate how we're using the land here. But I guess in the middle of an economic rush, you know, that might be a secondary or third consideration, you know?
I mean, I think the important thing is the idea of, you know, the Wild West concept of development that we've exported to the rest of the world. We were able to get away with that because back then the population wasn't so about to tip over the edge. And now it's really a global economy, and the other countries that are starting to really develop, they're using old development styles that we promoted. And it's really our responsibility to start at home developing with environmental sensitivity and also exporting that type of practice to the rest of the world.
Well said, and I agree. Now, how would you reduce one's ecological footprint as far as architecture goes? What are some ways you can do that?
Personally, I live in a built green home, and so I got introduced to the concept of ecological footprinting when my husband and I moved from a suburban home to a built green townhome in Beacon Hill, and we actually calculated how much our footprint shrank.
How is Built Green determined?
Built Green is a voluntary program through King and Snohomish County, and it starts with a home builder, and they use a checklist that moves them through different categories like site and water protection, for instance. They can elect, it's all voluntary, and they can elect to implement certain practices. The other categories are energy efficiency, materials, and resources. And there's even a piece about educating the future homeowner about how keeping their home green.
So what are some materials that you would use to build in a more green manner?
Mm-hmm. On our home, the builder used a system called advanced framing. And the concept here is, I guess, conventional homes, the studs in the walls typically are spaced about 16 inches apart. But when you select a beefier size stud, you can actually span that distance up to 24 inches. And so every time there's a stud, that's an area where cold air in the winter can leak through to your house. And then the insulation in between is what's blocking that. So when you actually reduce the amount of studs in your home, you're adding more insulation, and you're also reducing the amount of lumber that you need for your house.
But how does the additional separation between the studs affect the stability of the building?
It's a total wash, because you use a beefier stud instead of 2x6. I think you use like a 2x8 mm-hmm. or a 2x10.
And then what are some other types of materials you might use that you may not find ordinarily in a building or a structure?
Well, finished materials like flooring. Our home has bamboo, which can be grown and harvested within 7 years. So that's called a rapidly renewable resource, rather than using a hardwood that might take 20, 25 years to build that forest and then cut it down and start the process over again. You're selecting materials that can be reproduced quickly.
Where did the builder who built your house, where did he get these materials from? Is there a local place here in the Seattle area or Western Washington where they actually sell green building supplies? You can find a lot of bamboo. And let me ask mm-hmm. you real quickly about the bamboo. Are these like bamboo 2x4s, or this is just like for the finish?
It's just a veneer for the finish.
And then, so where would you find these types of supplies? Do builders only have access to them, or they can only buy them like in bulk?
Well, the market for that is really growing based on demand. Builders actually can source those products several places. But for a homeowner that wants to do a do-it-yourself project, a good place to start is the Environmental Home Center, which is located in Seattle. And you can actually see the physical products and find out how you can purchase those.
And then as far as reducing the actual footprint of the structure, the idea mm-hmm. is to build up. And by building up, I think one of the other gentlemen I had on my show earlier indicated that there's a lot of collective heat that's involved
right.
there. Can you talk about that a bit?
Sure. Well, our home is a two-story townhome. The original lot had one home, you know, an old bungalow. And when the builder took that down, he replaced it with four townhomes on the same site. And each of us were four couples. So we've just moved that occupancy, land occupancy, up from one person to eight people. And the other thing is that our heating system is very energy efficient. We don't have a furnace. We have a fireplace that acts a little different than your traditional fireplace, in that it's a gas fireplace that the heated air actually moves through vent systems into our closet, where there's a heat exchanger. And so the fresh air is coming in from the outside, and that heat is being exchanged and warming up the fresh air. And then that's moving through our house. And so we're getting the benefit of actually having fresh air cycle through our house every hour of the day. And we're using the aesthetic that everyone loves, a fireplace, to do that.
Now, this seems like a completely reasonable way to heat a structure. Was this done 100 years ago? And if so, why did we stop doing it?
Oh, this is a stumper.
Because, you know, electricity and electric heating, well, that works great. Heating oil works really, really well, too. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think one of the biggest concerns people had about fireplaces was because there's gases involved in that. And so you got to be really careful, I'd imagine, as to how you're distributing the heat and make sure you're not pumping carbon monoxide all over the house, too. So how do you keep the bad gases from getting around the house? How do you make sure that what's only being transferred mm-hmm. is the heat and not the smoke?
The beauty of the heat exchanger is the heat from the gas fireplace is actually being used to heat the fresh outdoor air. And then the noxious fumes are actually being vented outside right away. So I guess in a traditional fireplace, you would have, you know, if your chimney wasn't clean and that pressure wasn't working just right, in a minor way, you'd be getting soot in your living room. And in a major way, maybe it would cause a house fire.
If you're just joining us this morning, this is Treehuggers International on 107.7 The End. My name is Tommy Howe, and we're joined by Nora Daly Pang, who is a project associate at O'Brien & Company here in Seattle. And we're talking about green building practices. And I find this endlessly fascinating. I can talk about this stuff all day. And part of the reason is because I was an English major. Anything involving engineering or drafting is absolutely lost on me. And the idea that anyone could build a house to begin with is magic to me. I don't know how you do it. But the fact that you're able to do that and also reduce the footprint and also not just make it green friendly, but make it more economical too. It just seems to be a revelation. Have you noticed, I wouldn't say a sea change, but is there a change in attitude that's happened the last couple of years about how people approach these ideas?
Absolutely. Because this is what I do for work. Our job is to support design teams to come up with the most sustainable and appropriate solution for their particular project. Over the years, I've been working with teams. I really sense the design disciplines are already coming with a lot of know-how from past projects. And oftentimes, it's the client who is first setting that charge and saying, hey, I really want to do something great for the environment, or I want to do better than my last project.
Are these projects, are they really more economical? Do these really wind up saving your clients money in the end? And I think that's great to hear that, by the way, that these folks are coming to you saying, you know, we really want to do it this way. And that's why we're coming to O'Brien or whatever the company may be. But are these entities also finding they wind up saving money?
They have. And actually, there's the city of Seattle has published on their website some information about that. Their recent projects like the Seattle City Hall. I mean, the concept is you accept a bit of upfront cost for some of these upgraded features. Like if you wanted to have a really great energy efficient system, you might pay more upfront, and then you would calculate how soon would that pay itself back. So oftentimes projects look at a 10-year window because they want to see that payback on a system within 10 years. And the other piece of that is really doing the work up front versus adding on these ideas towards the end. So we like to enter a project right from the beginning before there's any kind of design solution so that we can bring all the people to the table, find out what's appropriate, and then integrate that into the design. Where you start getting into price escalations is that, you know, right before you enter construction, somebody comes on and wants to champion this as a sustainable building and they add things on.
Are those things they want to add on, could they be unreasonable at that date in the project?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm a firm advocate of integrated design because when you add something on, it might not be functioning with the rest of the system that you've created. And you also don't give the opportunity to designers to really cogitate on that and come up with a response to a product or a system.
Let's talk for a couple of minutes about your neighborhood in Beacon Hill. And your house was featured on KCTS, by the way, on Channel 9, folks. And that was last year when that was
that
on
was
television?
That was last week. Well, I mean, last year.
What was the crux of the program?
It was on ecological footprinting. And we were interviewed for our home and how we shrank our footprint from, I think, in half, actually, when we lived in the suburbs and then we moved to this townhome. We were tapping the earth's resources 50% more than we did last year.
And it sounds like you were also getting some local materials as well, so there was less energy spent in getting the materials to their ultimate destination.
Yeah, that's
true. The bamboo aside, but everything else was really coming from this area.
Yeah, the other piece of that equation is actually when you're building, how much of the waste is actually not going to the landfill, but going to be used again for something else. And our home builder is really committed to that. And he was able to accomplish diverting 80% of his construction waste from the landfill.
80%?
Mm-hmm. So, how do you accomplish that is at first, the first part is you're a smart developer and you minimize what your waste is to begin with. And then secondly, in the King County area, we're lucky in that we have resources. We have places where you can actually deliver recycled material and they'll receive that. Whereas in other parts of the country, you're going to have to self-haul that, you know, miles away, and it really discourages developers from doing that.
You know, one of the most interesting lessons I've learned from being in the Pacific Northwest is that the Native Americans here pretty much had all this figured out, because the Native Americans knew they had access to all these great resources. And I don't just mean cedar trees for canoes. It's funny. It's like the Native Americans here didn't have to really stress too much about getting water, because there always was water. So as a result, they were a little less innovative than folks in other parts of the continental U.S. where, well, we better figure out how to do this or else we're not going to have any water. Whereas here, it's like there was just an abundance of resources. And, you know, we had no problem building a longhouse or anything like that. Is it reasonable to say that some of those applications are kind of being applied to building here in the Pacific Northwest today?
I think it is important when you build a home in this region that you respond to the region's resources and climate. That's like your first, your elementary steps to getting on to a sustainable building and the end.
And let's talk about, thank you for mentioning the end, by the way. Thank you.
You're welcome.
let's talk about the green belts in your neighborhood in Beacon Hill, and you and your husband are very, very active in that. Why don't you explain for me why those green belts are there and what they're also used for?
Well, in Seattle, there's several green belts, and those have been established basically because the topography is so steep that a long time ago, Seattle decided, let's not build any homes here. Let's use the existing trees to stabilize the hillside. And so we live in Beacon Hill, but there's also green belts in West Seattle and all over Seattle. And the interesting thing is, when the street system was laid out, when they would intersect with a green belt of steep topography, instead of the street continuing, it turns into a staircase. So in our local neighborhood, we have four staircases that move you from the lower part of the neighborhood up to the top part of the neighborhood. And over time, those staircases have been overgrown with English ivy and the overhead streetlights. The bulbs have gone out and they're never replaced. And so it's become kind of a dark and scary place to walk through even during the day.
And that shouldn't be the case, because those staircases keep the community together. And
that's
I think
right.
You mentioned community connectivity.
Yeah, that's a really important part of the reason why our neighborhood got together, is because we wanted them to be safer, and we wanted the, you know, luxury of actually visiting our neighbors on foot. And Beacon Hill Elementary is at the top of the hill, actually like on the ridgeline of Beacon Hill. And a lot of parents want a safe place for their children to walk to and from school. And so currently, you know, these staircases are places for, you know, illicit activities, you know, drug dealing and other things, camping and even prostitution.
Things you don't want in your neighborhood.
Right. And so what our neighborhood got together, and we decided we wanted to address this. And some of the things are really simple. It's just having neighborhood cleanup parties, getting the litter out of there, cutting back the ivy, which is an invasive species in this area. And we also have pushed a little bit further and applied for a small and simple grant through the City of Seattle's Neighborhood Fund. And that actually allowed us to hire a landscape architect and a horticulturist to do some assessments and do some preliminary design work on what else we can do with the staircases to improve them. And now we're kind of going into round two. We're applying for another grant. This one will be an implementation grant, where the community will actually go out and do some physical work. And that hasn't been determined yet. But the really interesting, I think, and empowering thing for the grant program is that it requires a matching voluntary element from the neighborhood. So if we apply for $15,000 of grant money, we're obligated to actually contribute $15,000 of ours towards it. And that can be hard work, and also they do honor having things like neighborhood cookouts, just to get organized and get to know your neighbors before you have to do the hard work.
Any idea how that English ivy wound up here in Seattle? What boat did it get off of here in Elliott Bay? I'm not sure if I know what English ivy looks like. Can you describe it?
Oh, it is all over the place. So it's one of these garden plants that easily escape the garden and take over our green areas. And you'll notice it, you know, as you're driving down a road, maybe in West Seattle, you'll see the green carpet on the ground, but then it also grows right up the trees and strangles those trees. And basically, the issue with it is the coverage of it is so invasive, it precludes any of the native plants to grow in their natural habitat. And we know that, you know, the birds and the bugs also depend on their native species to thrive.
That's right, folks. If you're planting a garden, keep your plants native species. So with English ivy in mind, my guess is that you don't have much of that in your yard.
No, we don't. In fact, we don't have a lawn, which is a breakaway from tradition.
Yeah.
Our yard is small, so it's easy to manage, and it's completely planted with native plants. And we also have a deck and we have a patio, so it reduces down the area that we actually have to maintain and also allows us to do some outdoor entertaining. And we also have a rain barrel, which a lot of people in Seattle have rain barrels these days. And we use that to water our plants, hand water our plants.
These are such sensible ideas, especially a rain barrel, too. Instead of turning on the hose for half an hour, I mean, you've got all that access to that water anyway, so why not just direct it to where your plants are?
Also, by choosing native plants, they don't depend, they're not as thirsty as an exotic plant. And that's the issue with having lawns is that they require a lot of water to keep them green in the summer when they don't want to be. And they require fertilizers that wash off and enter our water table and eventually get out to the Sound and have been causing all sorts of problems for our marine life. And they also require pesticides to keep the bad bugs off of them. And so that's why we're really happy that we don't have a lawn, and it's a beautiful garden anyway.
And can you tell me real quick, a little plug for O'Brien and Company, are there any projects they're working on right now we should keep an eye out for? Is there anything specific that O'Brien and Company is doing right now that's particularly innovative?
Yes, our company just helped write a new checklist for the Built Green program, and this one is for Built Green multifamily. This is a really nice addition to residential in that we can help a developer who wants to do a whole community of buildings to really do them right and use our resources wisely and build homes that are going to add value for those homeowners by, you know, reducing their utility bills and providing healthy indoor air.
Nora Daly Pang from O'Brien and Company, thank you very much for joining us. And thank you for talking about your home and reducing your ecological footprint. Is there a good website someone could go to if they wanted to get more information on this on their own?
Oh, absolutely. If you wanted to calculate your footprint, your ecological footprint, you could go to www.myfootprint.org.
Myfootprint.org. And you just put in like the square footage, or you put in the materials of what you have, and it sort of does all the math for you?
It steps you through a really easy calculator. It's probably about 20 questions about your lifestyle right now, and it spits out how many acres you're actually tapping the earth to maintain your lifestyle. And it also gives you some tools on how you can improve that.
Nora Daly Pang, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thanks for being here.
Good to be here.
Wonderful to have you. Thank you very much. Well, that's going to do it for this week's edition of Tree Huggers International, but we'll be back next Sunday morning at 7:30, I promise. The opinions and views expressed on Tree Huggers International do not necessarily reflect the viewpoint of everyone at 107.7 The End or Entercom Seattle. And if you have a beef with something you heard, feel free to contact me, Tommy Howe, at though@entercom.com. As the producer of Tree Huggers International, you'll want to touch base with me because as producer, I am solely responsible for the content of this program. Again, Tommy Howe at though@entercom.com. Usually folks say nice things. You're welcome to say nice things. But, you know, if you're right, whatever the deal is, please tell me where in the area you are and tell me how to say your name. Also, keep emailing me those photos of you guys hugging trees. We'll have to get a gallery up here at 1077theend.com or at treehuggersintl.com. Just keep an eye out. I'll let you know. Also, remember, you can listen to Tree Huggers International anytime you want just by going to the Tree Huggers International page at 1077theend.com. Just look under shows, or by going to treehuggersintl.com and clicking on the show you want to hear. Again, if you want to calculate your ecological footprint, just go to myfootprint.org. That's myfootprint.org. And thanks again to Nora Daly Pang from O'Brien & Company for joining us this morning on Tree Huggers International. We will be back next Sunday morning at 7:30. But in the meantime, relax, put on a pot of coffee, make a bowl of cereal, scramble some eggs, and get ready for Jim Keller's Resurrection Flashback Sunday. It's next on 107.7 The End. We'll see you next time. Be well.